Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Alan Tate in this episode. Alan is Professor Emeritus with the Open University UK and has a very broad exposure in open education practice. He's also a Senior Fellow of Eden. I had the opportunity to talk with Alan following his keynote at the 2018 Eden Conference in Genoa, Italy, on a hot summer's day. In the background, you'll hear some enthusiastic chat from the next table, and in the foreground, you'll learn from one of the most authoritative and experienced distance educators in the world. Well, it's my great pleasure to be talking with Professor Alan Tate, who's Professor Emeritus of the Open University with a very, very broad and rich international heritage and practice in distance education. Alan, great to be talking with you today.
Good to be talking to you too, Mark.
Wonderful. And we're here in sunny Genoa for the Eden 2018 conference. It's been a great event so far. And Alan, I've just caught you after your keynote, which was very, very good and insightful. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, to begin with, can you just give us a bit of an overview of your career and publication history to date?
Okay, well, I spent my career almost entirely at the Open University UK, which has been a great privilege. I joined right back in the early days when the OU's educational vision was radically different and radically challenging to higher education in the UK at the time, bringing new kinds of people into university education, trying to teach in new kinds of ways, which was a necessary corollary for bringing in new kinds of people. You had to think very seriously about learning and teaching, which I don't think most universities had done at that time. It was taken as a given that if you had a PhD in chemistry, you knew how to teach, for example. So a commitment to technology. But also, and this was the area of, this has been the area of quite a lot of my career, a commitment to supporting students, both through the practice of tutoring, which was developed in part out of the Oxbridge approaches to individual small group teaching, but also a broader approach to student support, which at that time in the Open University was called counselling, which was really a kind of educational guidance approach. And that was where I spent quite a lot of my career. And that was also innovative within higher education practice in the UK at least. But the other interesting thing was that not long after the Open University UK was established, first announced in 1969, first year of teaching in 1971, other Open Universities began. For example, in a quite unlikely way, in Spain under General Franco, I think probably the only Open University that was set up under a dictatorship, but again set up with some overlapping of ambition, but some very different founding concepts, as you might expect from a Latin or a continental university system. But it meant that the world internationally began to open up, and that was one that I took advantage of, became very interested in. So that's also been a marker of my career, that I always enjoyed international discovery. So I set out as a young graduate with very inchoate career aspirations. I thought I'd like to write a bit, which I've been able to do. I thought I'd like to explore the world a bit, which I've been able to do. I thought I'd like to publish a bit, which I've been able to do. So the Open University has been a vehicle for me personally, for which I shall be always grateful.
Can you tell us a bit about your research then, particularly the ideas and themes that your work has provided that you think are still pertinent today?
Yes, well, I ought to put that in the context of my career, because really I've been a practitioner who insisted on thinking. And so my research and my publications have grown out of the fact that I was a practitioner in the field of student support, in the field of the management of teaching, and in the field of university management and leadership, if that's a term that people are comfortable with, as a dean and as a pro-vice chancellor. So my publication has grown out primarily from practice rather than coming in, if you like, from a discipline of the psychology or educational management or whatever. I've spanned both the regional centre side of the Open University. I've probably spent my 40 years in the Open University, half in a regional centre and half in the OU's headquarters in Milton Keynes. Half in the field of student support, as somebody who supported this student counselling activity. When the OU was set up, there were two dimensions to student support locally. One was the course tutoring, which was, if you like, subject or module based, carried out by people called tutors, but also locally in the 260 or so study centres the Open University had by people called Open University counsellors, and their job was not subject based primarily, but was around the individual in his or her place. And so I was responsible for Norfolk and Suffolk in the east of England for the Open University, and spent a wonderful 10 years driving around Norfolk and Suffolk, visiting study centres, meeting students, supporting counsellors, and making the sort of links into the community that was at that time thought to be important. Because in the pre-digital world, the only way we understood to bring the Open University experience near to students was to have some geographical footprint there. Mm. So Open University counsellors were based in a study centre, working with a group of students through his or her careers. I say his or her, that wasn't just terminology. The Open University was very unusual from the beginning in having more or less 50% women as well as 50% men.
Yes.
And when it started, that was by no means the case in higher education in the UK. There was a huge dominance of men. I'm completely reversed now, where boys have become a subject of concern for their educational attainment, not girls. But 40 years ago, that was not the case. So the Open University, which effectively responds to market demand, was always more or less 50% men or women. So the Open University counsellors worked with a small group of students, supporting them through their careers, through their degrees, irrespective of which courses they did. So they might go across faculties if they were wanting to have an open degree, or stick with, broadly speaking, within a faculty if they wanted a much more tailored degree towards a particular subject outcome. But the Open University counsellor was not course-based, but student-based and place-based. So they could meet students locally face-to-face and support them through telephone. So this was pre-email, Mark, which probably wouldn't be a time you can even remember.
I do.
You do. So that was an important part of where the OU started in terms of student support. What's also worth recording is that the Open University impacted on practice in other universities very much, both in terms of how courses were created. Other universities then began to use course teams to get collective approaches to course creation, rather than the old-fashioned, you know, I'm a university lecturer, this is my course, and I do it in private with my students, and nobody should even come in the room unless I give permission. But also with regard to student support, with students' guidance and counselling coming in on a much wider variety of campuses than just the Open University, as the ambition to involve a much wider section of population in higher education began to take shape across the UK. So that was the first part of my career. And then I joined the faculty of the School of Education, as it was originally, now the Faculty of Wellbeing and Education and Language Studies, so it's gone through a number of different nomenclatures and particular groupings. Eventually becoming dean of that faculty, and so taking part in quite serious management and leadership activities across that subject area, but also participating in university level challenges, really, that deans have to take part in. And then ending my career as a Provost Chancellor, academic or not quite, I went back to the faculty for a few years, very interestingly, I shouldn't forget that, ending up with the title Provost Chancellor Academic, so being responsible for all seven faculties as they were at the time of the university, managing, or better put, trying to manage seven deans. And that's interesting as a leadership challenge, because like being a dean, you realise that most of the people around you are cleverer than you are. So what kind of management stance do you adopt when that's the case? Well, it's one of enabling and support and respect, I think. But also remembering that there's a difference between being clever and intelligent. I think that was a distinction I learned the hard way as a manager. Many, many of my academic colleagues were much more clever than I was, but didn't always have the wider picture, which was necessary to try and take the institution forward. So you were forever running as a dean back between how the university was trying to identify its purposes for the next 5 years or so, back into the faculty to explain those, but also going back into senior management saying, well, that isn't exactly how the faculty sees it. We have a different perspective. I always try to explain when I was mentoring younger colleagues of management that you had, in the best possible way, to be two-faced, or at least you had to face both ways, out of the faculty to management at the senior level and into the faculty with senior management's perspectives, trying to explain and refine those. So I developed an interest in leadership practice in academic contexts. So if we move then on to how that's impacted on my publications and my research, it's been in both those areas primarily. So I've written a lot about student support in my time. I think in a kind of commonsensical way, trying to refine what was practice and express it conceptually, and so that it would be possible to build a theory. I don't think I was particularly great theory builder in that field, but I hope I added to the way that was conceived and shared not only within our university, but shared around the practice of open and distance learning more widely, internationally.
Yeah.
So that would be one bit of an agenda that I could perhaps claim, if you like. And then there are two other bits which are related. One would be around leadership and how that works effectively, not only in distance and e-learning, but also in higher education more widely. What does it mean to talk about leadership in higher education? Which shares a lot with leadership in a wide range of sectors, but I think also has something specific about perhaps leadership in creative areas. So I think if you ask people who were leaders in broadcasting or film or the BBC or even advertising, you'd find people talking in the same way, that you're surrounded by creative, clever colleagues. Mm. How do you refine institutional or organisational strategy out of that and support them at their best?
Yeah.
And then the third sector, I hope I've contributed there through my research publication. And then the third area will be, if you like, institutionally, how do open universities work? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And I probably spent the first half of my career talking about their strengths, which have been very significant, and nothing should take away from those. And the second half of my career talking about some of the challenges as I've seen them, which is the keynote that you just heard, where I believe we've actually reached a tipping point, a critical area, where it's fair to ask whether the Open University model that has served for 50 years, next year will be the 50th anniversary since the foundation of the Open University UK, whether that model is going to be sustainable for the next 25, or whether other environmental challenges from other sorts of institutions are going to make it a model which is under some very severe pressure, as indeed I believe it already is.
Yes, and of course you mentioned in your keynote too that the challenges of online, the fact that many institutions now are entering into the distance space purely because they're able to start afresh, applying digital technologies right from the start. Whereas a lot of open universities have a very, very deep and rich heritage, which they struggle to weave into this new future.
That's been the case. I believe that has been a very big struggle. I think in the Open University UK, I would say over the last 10 years, the number of people who said they didn't believe in the digital revolution has quieted and exited, although you'll still occasionally find an article which refers to that. But up until 10 years ago, I think there's research done which shows that if the technologies that exist up until you're the age of 40, you regard as part of the natural landscape. And for some people, technologies that come in after the age of 40 are regarded as an irritating intervention, merely fads of an irritating kind which will soon disappear. The digital revolution is not of that nature. It has been a privilege to live through it so far. We haven't bottomed it out by any means for education, as in other fields. I believe it's true, without being too offensive, that the Open University, while it's got great researchers in the field of open education resources, still regards it primarily as its responsibility when it writes its own modules to create the content in the way that has been the case for 50 odd years. We don't actually use other people's resources. We don't ask our students to say, go away and find out about this field and let's guide you through that. We still say, this is what this field consists of. Here's our course which will tell you about it. I hope I'm not out of date on that, but that's a way in which I think the digital revolution is outpacing the Open University, and not just the Open University UK by any means. That's the dominant model in the 60 or so Open Universities around the world.
Yeah, it presents a big challenge, I think, for many listeners. So of the three areas you mentioned, student retention or support, leadership, and also the challenges facing Open Universities, all three are highly relevant still. So drawing on that rich basis of research and observations you've had, what do you think are the key themes for open education and particularly digital education today?
I think we have to reconceive education for an online world, and that is very difficult. Difficult on a number of levels. It's difficult to know what's best to do, first of all, because there's no simple or easy answers. I don't pretend there are. It's difficult because of academic resistance, because in every major development, there are, to be frank, winners and losers. Mm. And so some people will accurately see that their basic livelihoods are actually under threat, to be blunt. I mean, occupational sectors do go into retreat. And somebody else at this conference spoke about the core skill for the future being adaptability.
Yes.
I think it was Darwin's insight originally about how evolution supports some species and doesn't support others. Mm. So being adaptable is a core skill, which I don't think features in most graduate outcomes. As a matter of fact, important though it is. So it's reconceiving how we deliver education. Mm. I often use in my teaching the very simple example. If you take business studies teaching, we might in the past have said, here are the three most dominant models of marketing, please evaluate them. Now we should be saying, please go away and identify which you think are the three most important models of marketing and come back and discuss them. We're not going to tell you which they are in our course materials. There's actually a ton of stuff out there which should allow you to discover that. And if there's any skill which any education qualification ought to be delivering nowadays. It is investigating, researching the resources which exist, evaluating them to throw out the dross, and being able intellectually to create a case of which are the important ones, because that is actually a task that faces every adult every day of his or her life.
Yes.
And if we look at the informal learning that's going on around us, in every street, in every bus station, in every airport lounge, every cafe, as you see people working off their phones or off their tablets, they're mostly doing that. They're looking at resources that are out there, evaluating them, and making decisions about what to do, what to buy, where to go.
Yeah, which is essentially what you'd expect from someone who's educated, wouldn't you? The ability to go out there, find information, evaluate it, critique it, and synergize it into new forms of knowledge which best suit the situation.
Yes.
I know too that you're a strong advocate of education quality. So when you say reinventing education, you're not suggesting for a moment that standards be dropped at all, but rather that we just approach the educational mechanism from a slightly different perspective.
I do think that, although I wouldn't want to be trapped into a conservative conception of what quality is by such a statement, Mark. I think quality is a contested agenda. You'll have heard me say, but I hope you won't mind me saying it again, that when I turn on BBC Radio 4 and there's a discussion about universities and they refer to the best universities in the UK, I know which ones they're going to mean. Yes. And of course, the excellence of the research-intensive universities, the so-called Russell Group, is an excellence. It's a particular kind of excellence. Mm. It isn't difficult, frankly, to have dropout at 1% when you select your students so very carefully through their prior qualifications and then through interview with their personal qualities and make sure that they succeed. And to be honest, quite a lot of students in the Russell groups teach themselves through their careers. If you're doing something of a different nature, like the Open University and a lot of other universities in the UK now, which is to admit a wider range of students from families who don't have higher education, from areas with poverty and deprivation, of cultures which aren't immediately aligned with the sorts of culture that we find in the university, you're doing something actually much more ambitious. You are not going to have the same retention rates, and the degree of risk you take with your students, and the degree of risk which, of course, let's not forget, they take on in investing now very substantial money, or at least in the form of debt in England, and also self-esteem. I mean, don't let's forget that people who take that risk are risking not succeeding, and their self-esteem will be damaged when and if that happens. That's a different sort of ambition, and it's a different sort of quality. The value that we add in the Open University to our students' lives and to their careers and to their personal development is of a different order to the value which, in my view, is much less that the Russell Group take. They take very little risk. In fact, their admissions procedures are designed to take almost no risk, for the most part. You'll find wonderful cases where that's different, of course, than the sorts of risk and the value that we add, and not just the Open University, there are other sorts of regional universities which look to their local populations and recruit, for example, with very high levels of minority ethnic participation, which is another sort of challenge for people for whom English may be, at least in their families, an additional language. So I think we have to fight for a quality agenda which acknowledges a wider range. I'm not suggesting we dump the definition of quality in excellence that the Russell Group offer, but I think there are a wider range of definitions of quality and excellence. We must make sure that discussions of quality and excellence in the UK and internationally also acknowledge those. So I feel quite fierce about that, as you could perhaps hear from my tone of voice.
Well, perfectly validly. I think particularly given the fact that the OU does take a lot of risk with its student intake. We are open entry, so anyone can actually apply for a degree and begin that journey. It does present special challenges for student support. And again, just coming back to your earlier discussion about your research in that area, no doubt it was driven by that concern for those students.
It is. I won't pretend that my social and political perspectives don't play a part in my commitment to the Open University. And I think you'll find, at least in many of the first generation of Open University appointments, that was indeed the case. The Open University was a risky place to take your career because it challenged many of the established assumptions about what a university was. We took people without qualifications. What a crazy thing that was to do. We took people from a much wider social classes, and if you look at whenever educational opportunity has been expanded, there have been people who said, why do those sorts of people need an education? What's the point? They don't need it in their jobs. It'll be a complete waste of their effort and public money, and they probably won't succeed anyway. So that sort of rhetoric about the way in which social goods are distributed was very much against the Open University at the time of its establishment. And I think one of the things the Open University should claim credit for is we've played an enormous part in the acceptance of that agenda in such a widespread way across the UK. That has not been the Open University on its own, but the Open University can claim a significant part of the credit for winning that argument about who goes to university, women as well as men, people from a much wider range of occupational backgrounds and none, people in family and in work, people taking opportunity later in life. So you've got two agendas there. One is a kind of remedial agenda, people who've been excluded because of elitist approaches in the past, and one is an agenda of lifelong learning, which is essentially an agenda of participation and inclusion.
And of course now a lot of universities are focusing on that very same, for want of a better term, market, which does make things quite difficult for the universities, the open universities, who were built to initially address those social concerns. I couldn't help thinking of educating Rita, as you talked through, particularly with women entering education as a result of the Open University. I remember watching that movie for the first time, thinking how incredible it was that education could change a life so much. I mean, I know it's a fiction movie, but I'm sure it's actually representative of quite a few OU graduates.
Well, it was fictional, I have to say, in the way in which it portrayed how the Open University supports its students. Nonetheless, when it took the issues of class and gender, which it did in Rita's life, it was very much to the point. And of course, some of the recent stories which have come out as a result of the Me Too movement about the way women have been abused in universities are truly shocking. Sadly, education is not excluded from the sort of abuse that has taken place in so many sectors of our society. Yes, gender and class have been major prisms through which opportunity has been distributed, and the Open University can claim a huge amount of credit in changing the terms of definition, changing the rules of the game on those two scores.
Absolutely. So, Alan, in your keynote this morning, you talked about the challenges facing open universities. You've done a lot of research in the area of open universities and the futures, the student support mechanisms, leadership. What research would you most like to see at the moment? What do you think would be most pertinent for online education in particular, right at this particular time?
Well, the first line I think I would suggest would be a line that relates to the way in which the quality agenda is contested. There are a million and one articles, and somebody who's edited a number of journals in my time I must confess grown slightly impatient of reading them, which say I taught this group, these sorts of people succeeded and these didn't, but they're very much at the micro level. If we want to play a full part in the definitions of quality in a plural and a heterogeneic way, we have to have data to support that. What sorts of people are we admitting, and who are succeeding and who are not? And what sort of lives do they go on to lead? So there's a dimension in which we need more data about who we teach and how they succeed and what might be associated with their success and their sometimes not success. And also I think we need longer term data. So we need more life stories, more biographical data, which is difficult and expensive to organise as research because it's not, you know, micro snapshots. So I think there's a whole demographic element in which that quality debate needs to be supported. So that will be one thing. I think we need research into the way in which open university models are working around the world. So I think we shouldn't look only within the UK. There are some 60 open universities globally. There's a major job to be done in getting that data to be transparent. I've tried to get data out of open universities about where their students succeed. You can get data about who they admit, because they're usually very proud of that. This is how big we are. Getting data about how many students have succeeded is much, much more difficult. I think there's a need more broadly, though, to look at the open university model. What are its current organizing principles conceptually, and how do they need to change? And in particular, I think we need to look at that in wider higher education landscapes, because the higher education landscape has changed radically in the UK, it's changing radically elsewhere. There are the new entrance institutions, the online universities. Some of those are private, some of those are private not-for-profit, some of those are private for-profit. There's been a very sad story in the USA in particular about the last category and way in which they have abused students and indeed been taken to court on the very grounds of that, and that does the reputation of open and online learning a terrible amount of damage, takes you right back to the days of correspondence schools, some of which also abused their students. I think we need research into institutional models at a meso level, to use the terminology of this conference, micro, meso and macro. I think that's very important. And I think thirdly, at the meso level, there's the way in which government or an intergovernmental policy is working. If we look at the next 15 years in the UN Sustainable Development Goals, we're looking to take university participation from something like 250 million presently to 400 million by 2030. Essentially, to put it in a shorthand, raising the number of middle-income countries from elite to mass higher education systems almost universally. That is an enormous challenge. There's no way that can be done by building campuses alone. That's simply impractical, as well as undesirable, because I'm very pleased to see UNESCO has reintroduced the importance of lifelong learning, which has disappeared in terms of policy discourse for the last 20 years, probably. That's come back in the recent Sustainable Development Goals, particularly SDG 4. So there has to be online learning as a part of that. But I also think, if we look at the way the two traditions have grown up, campus-based and distance and online, they've grown up separately. They've grown up separately for a number of good and bad reasons. Certainly 20 years ago, if people like me were being unkind, we'd say campus-based teaching hasn't changed for the last 30 years. The only people who are interested in change are those of us in the open universities. That is absolutely not the case now, although not enough people in open universities realise that, as should do. But if you go onto most campuses in developed countries, the students are engaging with learning management systems. They're looking at multimedia teaching via their learning management system. Their tutors are putting videos on there, or they're referring them out to YouTube. They're engaging with their tutors and their lecturers, and with each other, of course, importantly, electronically through email or chat forums. They're sitting in cafes and in pubs and on trains, learning as open university students are too. So the boundaries between what is now campus-based study and open university study are dropping in terms of methods. They're not dropping so sharply in terms of who they're teaching, so campus-based still substantially engaged with school-leaving full-time students and open universities remaining sticking with their core market of part-time. Yes. That won't be a stable boundary either, in my view. So I think it is quite possible, and this is why I think there's a threat to the open university model, which we have to be open about, that the blended learning, which retains some element of campus-based presence, but offers all the affordances of online learning to campus-based students, may become a much more significant mode and may drop the boundaries so significantly that it sucks the lifeblood out of the institutional model of the open university, at least in part. For some open universities, I'm sorry to say, I believe in the next 15 years it will suck it out to an extent that they will no longer exist institutionally. Mm. And that will be because they haven't noticed it's happening. Because open universities are unusual within their own societies, there is a tendency for them to act as a bubble. People talk to each other within the open university and they don't engage with their field of higher education more broadly.
Yeah.
So I think paying attention to your environment within your society as an open university educator is absolutely crucial. So I think a very interesting area to watch is how campus-based universities develop blended offers.
Yes.
Which acts as a threat. Now, there are a tiny number of open universities, I can think of two, which have developed campus-based operations. One in which, where I have a visiting professorship, is the Open University of Hong Kong, who now have as many students as their campus-based offer as they do in their distance or online offer. Isn't that an interesting development?
So do they facilitate that with study centres around Hong Kong?
Hong Kong isn't really big enough to need study centres.
True.
So they have a central campus, or I think there's one or two campuses, but they're very close together. But they have varied their offer in the way that campus-based universities are varying their offer. This is an exaggeration, but for the sake of argument, there's barely a university in the UK which doesn't offer an online master's degree. The master's level provision in the UK has so many campus-based universities participating in it online, and it makes it very difficult for the Open University UK to find its place in that, especially when the brand identity of many campus-based universities is, to be honest, stronger than the open universities.
In your paper, you mentioned founding father syndrome, I think was the name you gave it. So that's where a university, an open university, would tend to look inwardly for answers, because we are the founding fathers.
Yes.
We know how all of this works.
Yes.
We're fine, thank you very much. But your strong call is that actually that's insufficient. We do need to take a broader look at what's going on around us.
Yes.
A broader look internationally at what other open universities are doing. You mentioned a few earlier on in terms of how they're actually thriving under the current environment. So some very interesting challenges await us.
Yes, I owe that term founding father syndrome to a colleague, David Vincent, who was a former Provost Chancellor, who I served alongside in my time. Yes, it's that sense of moral exclusion of innovation In other words, we've done it this way because it was the right way to do it, and any thought of change is a betrayal of our values. You can betray the values of an institution, but to say that you have to do it the same way forever is absolute cul-de-sac for an institution, and some institutions will fall into that trap, in my view.
Can I come back to an earlier distinction you made between on-campus and distance education? And in my experience, how they actually enter into the online space is quite different. So an on-campus institution seeking to go online will typically record lectures, stream them, make them available to students after the class. A distance university will tend to actually digitise its courseware and perhaps make more use of online pedagogies, such as you mentioned earlier. Go and find out about marketing. Critique three models, synergise them, come back with the one that you think is best. So the two sorts of institution tend to extend themselves into the online space rather differently. If open universities were to move toward a more blended mode, do you think that would be as a result of course materials becoming more blended, or would it be an open university seeking to take its professors and putting their lectures or presentations online?
I don't support the latter view. I think some of the ways in which some institutions have approached online teaching by recording their professors, putting them online, is fairly grim educational experience. It's also the way in which, at least in the early days, many institutions approached MOOCs. And there's nothing more dispiriting than sitting through a half-hour lecture by somebody long established as a professor who doesn't know how to present on TV or video. And of course, that was part of the revolution the OU went through back in the first 10 years, was how to teach using television. And we had a lot of success and some failures too. But I think you're right about the way in which institutions grow from their own institutional habits, if you like. And I think it's a complete mistake, which I've heard being made within some universities, that of course anything that comes out of a campus-based university as they approach online learning is bound to be poor quality. That isn't the case. And I think there's evidence of that in MOOCs. I'm not one of those who thinks MOOCs are going to replace university teaching as a method, but equally I'm not one of those who thinks they've been a waste of time and are an educational nonsense. As somebody who's taken a number of MOOCs as a student, as well as somebody who researches into MOOCs now, I've been staggered by the number of campus-based universities that produce really interesting multimedia pedagogy. And I've thought, where did they get the expertise for that? Where has that come from? They've got no record in it. And yet they found people on their campus who've produced the most exciting MOOCs. And of course, that goes alongside some of the MOOCs which are absolutely tedious and backward-looking in the way in which they've particularly approached video. I think what some of the on-campus universities are doing importantly for their students is to provide some of the flexibility around time and place which distance and online learning has always provided. So the campus, you don't have to come to the campus to learn, or exclusively to the campus to learn. And I have to say, one of the most exciting career options in the future is going to be redesigning campuses for 21st century learning. If you've got a young person who might go into architecture, I think that's going to be a great specialty, because almost all campuses are designed for 20th century learning.
That's right.
And they're pretty hopeless design, frankly. So I think that flexibility around time and place is quite exciting, the way campus-based universities are altering their programs. And of course, many full-time students in many universities are also working part-time. So what exactly is the definition of a full-time student anymore in many places? A lot of these boundaries are simply evaporating in the face of the realities of 21st century life. Now, how open universities move out of there, it gives us a huge number of advantages. Firstly, because we've understood that teaching shouldn't be based around the individual lecturer doing his or her own thing in private. We've known that for a long, long time. It was a huge culture shift we went back through 50 years ago, more or less. And we have also developed very strong practice around individual student support and individual student tutoring. I have to say that practice is widely known now and widely practiced elsewhere, actually in significant part because of the way other people's staff help the Open University achieve its mission by working for us part-time as tutors, so our practice has spread elsewhere. But as I say, we have these very small number of examples where Open Universities have also set up campuses. Without being specific, the ones I've seen have not taken advantage in their campus-based practice of some of the innovation that they have in their distance and online practice.
Right.
So I think the way in which blended learning is delivered in the future is a huge adventure which we have to ride next.
I'm looking forward to seeing how all that works out. You mentioned earlier investigating student stories. I remember there was a book in the Kogan Page series, Open Distance Learning. I think it talked about student stories. There's one chapter per student. It was part of the MAODE that I did 15 years ago. And I remember being quite surprised, actually, by some of the student stories and how the Open University opened up opportunities for them that they never thought possible. Perhaps it's time to revisit that type of work.
Yeah, we're fascinating. Mm.
Ellen, I'm interested in two people you would like to recommend as other folk to talk with about their research, their perspectives on online education. Perhaps one whose work has influenced you, and another perhaps young and rising star you see coming through.
Okay, well, I'll answer that as best I can, but it's going to be not quite under your terms. Firstly, the one person I would recommend to you, you can't talk to because sadly we lost him 2 years ago, and that's a close colleague, as he was to me, Roger Mills. And his writing about student support and tutoring is well worth revisiting. In some ways, he and I share the same origins, and he was a practitioner primarily who insisted on thinking and writing, and his work has the strength that I believe comes out of that sort of profile. So I would recommend colleagues to go and look out Roger Mills's work on tutoring and student support. And the second person isn't young and coming up because he's middle-aged and come up, and that is Antonio Teixeira, who is a professor in the Open University of Portugal. And he has, I think, one of the strongest grasps of the landscape that I've come across. He is able to give you a synopsis, a summary, of the online and distance landscape in a way that I don't think I've met anybody else being able to do at this present time. His work is published. He speaks fluent English. How much of it is published in English, I'm not sure, but you can always do your best with Google Translate if it's in Portuguese.
Absolutely.
So those would be my two suggestions.
Great. I'll certainly seek Antonio out, and I will definitely link to Roger's work. Ellen, it's been a real privilege talking with you. There's been some interesting Italian conversation in the background for a lot of the interview. Thank you very much for your work, and thank you for participating in the podcast series.
Great pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
You can find Ellen's profile and links to his research from our website. His Twitter handle is Alan Tate. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website www.onlinelearninglegends.com to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.